Cassar Jane Show, Talk Radio for Fine Minds, airs Wednesdays, 3 p.m. Eastern, and is always available for your listening pleasure at HallieCassarJane.com. Thank you so much for joining me. I am Hallie Cassar Jane. Today on the Hallie Cassar Jane Show, we are stepping inside the boxing arena with boxing, an inside look at the sport of kings. Move over, HBO pay-per-view. The Hallie Cassar Jane Show is loaning you free a ringside seat as we explore the world of championship boxing. Joining me today is J.R. Tunney, the son of legendary boxer Gene Tunney, who will talk about his book, The Prize Fighter and the Playwright, that chronicles the unlikely friendship between the champion boxer and world-famous playwright George Bernard Shaw, a book that offers extraordinary insight into the world of boxing champions and even tells a love story. Also with me, retired light heavyweight champion Glenn Johnson, nicknamed The Gentleman and the Road Warrior. Rounding out the hour, I'll talk to Rick Encinosa. Rick is an author and boxing historian, considered one of the top 10 boxing historians worldwide. It's going to be a knockout of a show, promise. So sit back and enjoy your ringside seats to the Hallie Cassar Jane Show, talk radio for fine minds and sports lovers. But before we begin, a brief message from our sponsors. You are listening to the Hallie Cassar Jane Show, talk radio for fine minds. The Hallie Cassar Jane Show is always available online at HallieCassarJane.com. Today, the Hallie Cassar Jane Show is brought to you by Audible.com, a leading provider of spoken audio information and entertainment. Listen to audiobooks whenever and wherever you want. If you want to listen to it, Audible has it. With over 150,000 titles in virtually every genre, you'll find what you're looking for. Get a free audiobook and 30-day trial today by signing up at www.audibletrial.com/ The Hallie Cassar Jane Show. Is someone you love living with frequent pain? Are they spending more time just sitting in a chair or lying in bed or going to the ER more often? Other than taking them to the doctor, you may not know what else to do. Treasure Coast Hospice can help in more ways than you may realize. Even if you don't think your loved one is ready for hospice care, their experts can evaluate your loved one's condition and direct you to the right resources in our community. Call Treasure Coast Hospice to learn more or visit tchospice.org. Hello, this is Hallie Cassar Jane, host of the Hallie Cassar Jane Show, talk radio for fine minds. Join me Saturday evenings at 2200 hours, that's 9 p.m. London time, on my favorite radio station, Radio Catalonia. See you there. J.R. Tunney is the son of legendary boxer Gene Tunney. Jay has written quite an extraordinary book, The Prize Fighter and the Playwright, the story of his father's life and his father's astonishing friendship with Pulitzer Prize-winning playwright George Bernard Shaw. But the book is even more. It is truly a love poem to his father, Gene, who in 1928 retired from boxing as the first undefeated world heavyweight champion in modern history, one of the most famous athletes of the Roaring Twenties and perhaps all time. Jay has written for publications worldwide, including the New York Times Magazine and the Asian Wall Street Journal. He is a member of the Governor's International Advisory Council for the Shaw Festival in Toronto, Canada, and he is Vice President of the International Shaw Society. As I said, he's written quite a wonderful book, The Prize Fighter and the Playwright. Welcome to the Hallie Cassar Jane Show, Jay Tunney.
Thank you, Hallie. Thank you.
It's great to have you here. Listen, I think that you can tell how much I really enjoyed your book. What a man your father was. What a life. Let's start with the fact that he truly was a rare man. Let's talk about his humble beginnings first, though. He was the son of Irish immigrants. Give us a little background.
Yes, he was. Born in 1897, and he was born in Greenwich Village, New York. His father was an Irish stevedore, and his mother was an Irish lady, and both mother and his mother and father lived about 7 miles away from each other in Mayo, County Mayo, Ireland, and never knew each other until they got to New York City. It was amazing. And they met and married and had 7 children, and Dean was the eldest boy, the third eldest child, the eldest boy, and had a future to look forward to on the docks as a stevedore. And so he chose to try another venture, try another career, and he chose boxing. And even though his mother thought, like many Irish mothers, Irish Catholic mothers, she felt that she would have made the perfect priest of the family. And maybe his sensibility should have naturally put him in that direction. I don't think he would have made a very good priest, but he had to figure out a life where he felt he wanted to make some money, which was more and more the thing back in the 1910s and the 1920s.
He had quite a relationship with both of his parents, and I think that's important to explore a little bit because I think it plays out in his life. He adored his mother, who he called Nana, right?
Yes, that's correct.
And she was pretty much the traditional loving Irish mother. But the father, now talk to us about him.
The father, I'd always said it was the father that gave him his spunk. And there's a lot of truth in that. I think the mother was much more of a spiritual kind of lady, but a really hard worker and wonderfully sympathetic to all her children. The father was not. He was really much more your typical standard poor Irish, hard-drinking, tough Irish father. And I think Dad ran into that very much so. He was a tough guy, John Tunney, his name was. He didn't box in the ring, but he was a great fan of boxing and fighting one another. And he was a very hard drinker. He had a gin distillery up in the bathtub of the flat. And he just was a tough guy. I mean, and Dad learned a certain obstinacy of life and contracts in life from his dad. And I think it was that obstinacy really in the end that got Dad through the heavyweight, all the way through to the heavyweight boxing championship of the world, and with perhaps finest record in boxing history.
No doubt about that. Even as a kid, he was different than his siblings, right? I mean, he embraced solitude, and there was a poet in him from the get-go, right?
Yeah, very much so. There was a poet in him, and also there was a fisticuffness in him. He didn't like getting batted around by the other tough guys in the neighborhood, and there were plenty of them. But he did have this wistful kind of side to him. He always did, a poetic nature. His younger brother, Tom, never met the other younger brother, John, who was killed during the First World War. Tom was a detective, and Tom didn't have, he had the toughness, for sure, but he didn't have Dad's wistfulness, I don't think. And this went on and simply grew into a great love for poetry and a great love for life and romance and whatnot. Now, he's a very interesting, complex guy. Man.
Yeah, and I think we're going to explore that because I think that's what made him so unique. Boxing was a way out of the neighborhood for sure, right? He got his first pair of gloves on his 10th birthday.
The way out was not boxing for him. The way out was joining the United States Marine Corps.
Well, yeah.
For war. That got him out. That grew him up. He was able to do boxing in the Marine Corps, and he won the AEF, the American Expeditionary Forces Championship, in France during the First World War in about 1919. And he came back, and that segued into a professional career back in New York City in boxing. And it made all the difference for him in the whole world.
Absolutely. But he'd already gotten, I mean, he was already into boxing prior to going off.
He was, yeah, exactly right. Even before he joined the Marine Corps, he had his first two or three professional bouts, exactly.
You know what fascinated me amongst the many things that fascinated me, but this really did, was this mind control, this self-control that he mastered. His father, I always think that it's because his father hit him and it was his way of like, you're not going to get to me and I'm going in where I need to go from what I read in the book. But talk about like he would stand on a chair in the dark, and he would count matches.
Yeah. Well, it was to build up the thing that was becoming very popular in those days, which was individual willpower. And frankly, I think he also had Taoism a bit of, and which was just coming on at that time into the Western estates and people who were readers and whatnot, and Taoism and Zenism, Zen.
Right.
And I think it taught a certain self-control through meditation and whatnot, but also willpower. Power was being espoused by different writers at that time as a way for an individual to achieve in society. And education was not in those days. It was mostly willpower and an ethical approach to your life, a moral approach to your life. What we are now concerned about with just raw success was not then as popular in the early 1900s. And so Dad was full of willpower. He learned willpower, this little boring, as you were just talking about, like counting your sticks and going around the block five times before you open the front door to your house to go to bed. Or even after you did that, you passed him. He loved ice cream, and he would have ice cream served to him at the table, and then it was served to the whole family. He would push it aside and not make little tiny little
fascinating. I mean,
gestures
the man,
like
right.
that. He trained his will to so he could control what he was doing. That was exactly what he felt.
Unbelievable. He had many mentors along the way, and I think that was, you know, pretty great for him. One was this Dr. Van, I could never, how do you pronounce his name?
Van Vliet. Vliet. Vliet, Dutchman. Yeah,
right, and he taught him, right, and he taught him the magic of books. So talk a little bit about that.
Well, he did, there were the magic of, there were books that he had in his office. This is a doctor that was not only a scientist, but he was also a lover of reading and a lover of books. And he had a tremendous library right in his office of D'Artagnan, the Three Musketeers, and all types of those wonderful books that we all read in the early days. And he also had wonderful advice for Dad. Maybe his own personal advice to Dad was the most important thing that Dad ever received in his life, and that was that he was capable of really doing anything if he wanted to do it badly enough and achieve it. He didn't have to just copy what his father was doing on the docks. Gene could read books. He could go to the opera. He could go uptown to the Metropolitan Opera House and indulge in opera watching and listening, which Dad used to do. He used to stand in the back part of the old opera house there and hear Caruso and Wagner and all that. And that's how he began to learn and cultivate himself. But it was really through much of the advice and the repositories of culture that the Dr. Van Vliet was able to hand over to Dad, or
which became so much of who he became later. Willie Green taught him how to avoid punches, opponents.
Correct. Willie Green was a hot stuff guy that lived down there in the streets. And he had been a good fighter, and he had been a circus actor, a clown, actually. And he knew how to do somersaults in the air, and he knew how to do all kinds of things. But he settled in on boxing because boxing could be a moneymaker in those days. And so Willie Green took it very seriously, and he was really quick and very fast, and he knew all the ins and outs of boxing and how to trade punches. And he showed Dad, after beating him around the block for many different times, Dad became fascinated by just getting better all the time and learning, being able to learn. When Dad learned, he really packed it away. He was evidently able to just have one of these steel trap minds of being able to learn where to duck and how to duck, and when Willie Green gesticulated in some way or patted his eyelash, he knew how to duck or to block or to sidestep it. And he learned all types of things from Willie Green. And he finally was able to beat Willie Green at boxing, at sparring, after, I think, 50 times they met. And then Dad grew stronger, and he began to lick him. And that's when Green finally said, okay, Gene, you know, onward, you ought to take boxing seriously, become a pro, and get with it. And that's
and
what
off
happened.
Off he went.
Off he went.
And off he went. I think the other part. Yeah, the other part about Willie Green was he was a thinking man.
Yeah, he was a thinking man. True, but I was just saying he did learn from Willie Green that you can never ever give up, and that's where this belligerence helped him. He seemed to be born with an overdose of belligerence. Dad did. He was a gentleman. He was a belligerent gentleman, you know. And he just really learned that from Green, the never giving up no matter what happened. So it really helped at the first Harry Greb fight when he was a light heavyweight. And Greb broke his nose the first punch of the fight and just destroyed Dad. The one fight Dad lost in his whole career, and he lost two quarts of blood. I mean, it was really a mess. Because Dad was a bleeder in those days. He found he was a bleeder, and so but then he grabbed four times afterwards. He had learned from that first fight how to beat. They called him the Pittsburgh windmill, and how to beat it. And he came back indeed and beat him four times afterwards. So it was that's the kind of guy Dad was.
You know, a fascinating man.
Yeah.
Fascinating person. Let's get to George Bernard Shaw. Let's get some background. So, I mean, for those who don't know who Shaw was, I can't imagine anybody didn't know who George Bernard Shaw was, but give us a real quick, because I'm watching that clock.
You bet. Shaw was the second greatest playwright in the English language. Many people think that. He was famous from about 1895 until 1950, and he died 55 years later. He had written more plays than any other playwright, about 55 plays in his lifetime. He had written five novels before he wrote his plays. He thought he would be a novelist. And he started at age 21. He wrote five novels, all non-starters, weren't successful. He couldn't get them to the publishers. And then he went on, when he saw that that wasn't successful, he went on to write plays, and he became very successful at writing plays. And he did this he became most famous in the 1910s and 19, all the way through to about 1935, 1940, when the war started, Second World War. But he was the most famous man in the world. He was known for his quick witticisms. His thoughts on life were always droll and always unique, and newsmen picked him up and usually carried him on the wires. And people from New York to Johannesburg would say typically, God, did you read what Shaw said yesterday in London? You know, kind of thing. He's always saying something that was germane of the day, some germane comment of the day, and relative.
And he was also very interested in boxing. And I think that...
Loved boxing.
And actually he'd written a story about boxing.
He had written a story, a book, one of the novels. Was about boxing called Patricia Barnes' Profession. And it was about an Irish boxer, out of his own imagination, an Irish boxer that went on to become world champion.
Right, just like your dad.
Undefeated. I'll tell you what it was. It was that Bernard Shaw saw his own creation in Gene Tunney.
Absolutely.
Like the embodiment of everything that moral, physical, intellectual excellence all rolled into one. And that's really what it was.
You know, when I was reading the book, Jay, it was interesting to me. I mean, they had a 40-year-long friendship. Shaw was so much older than your dad. He was 40 years maybe older than your dad, if I recall. 41, but what I thought was that they were, first of all, they were so alike in many ways, and that's going to be something we'll talk about in a second. But Gene might have been his son. He might have been the father that I think that your father wished that he might have had, and he was his teacher.
That's correct.
And I'm trying to roll it into, you know, real quick, because there's so much I want to talk to you about besides this. But I have to say, what a remarkable relationship. I mean, how many of us have that kind of connection with another human being in our life? How fortunate for both of them.
It's very, very true. And a lot of it, it was the fighter, dad's style of boxing and the way he looked. His attractiveness, physique and whatnot, captured Shaw a great deal.
Who was not a very good-looking man by him at all.
Actually, he wasn't that in the beginning, his younger days. And the women loved him anyway. They loved his intellect. I think they really loved Shaw's intellect. They all thought he was a genius, and he was. He really was a genius. With words and his imagination, it was just profoundly incredible. And but he liked that because the Irishness to begin with, they had the same sense of humor. You know, that twinkle of the eye, and they would pull
the blarney, the cute, the adorable.
Irish. Very, very Irish. They had the thing. So they basically had the same sense of humor. So they really got along. But Shaw was attracted to Dad because Dad was the great hero of the day, that is, the great athlete hero of the day. And he was kind of the embodiment of masculinity, if you will want to say that. Shaw loved being beside him, loved rubbing elbows with that.
Shaw was not known
in his plays. He was known as rather a sexless writer of plays. He was a great intellect, and he believed in purity and morality and ethics.
He was a brilliant man in so many different ways.
Exactly right.
I want to talk to that Jack Dempsey. Yeah. We have to move on. You know, we got a half an hour and we're almost done. What was Dempsey really like? I mean, from your father.
Jack Dempsey was a great, great guy. He was a tremendous fighter. Not Shaw's style of fighter. Dempsey was like a caveman in the ring, and he came at you, and he really came at you like a jungle cat, you know. But if you ducked him and got away from him, Dad used to outdance him and outblock him and just keep his distance and then whip in with a sharp right or a left like a javelin. And he had Dempsey's number. He could always get around Dempsey because Dempsey was just a slugger, a basher, and a masher, like John L. Sullivan, the same kind of fighter. But he was a great fighter. That kind of fight was not Shaw's thing at all. He liked the classic fighter, the one who was scientific and knew his sport with brains and brawn. That was his kind of style, and that's what Gene Tunney was completely.
Let's talk a little bit about the fight. Of course, the first fight, we know that went down, and then they had the rematch. We can't talk about your dad and not talk about that. Question about the rematch. First of all, let's just do it. It was controversial.
Yeah.
Let's talk. I mean, I have 1 minute to give you on that one, because
absolutely,
my question's going to be to you, Jay, so you can lead yourself here. Is when your father looked back at that in later years, what was his thought on that?
His thought was he could always get up. He could have always gotten up and mashed Dempsey. Just the way it happened, the way he always said it was. He just wished that Dempsey would have had a third fight to prove once and for all who was the better man in the ring at that point in time. He and Tex Ricker, the great promoter, begged Dempsey to have that third fight, but Dempsey would not do it.
And why?
The reason is he thought he would be blinded by the punches that Dad threw. Dad had this. He punished his opponents with the way he punched. and twisted and lacerated the skin and the eyebrow and that fleshy part up there. He could draw blood very easily. And Dempsey was blinded by it after the second fight. And if a third fight he was scared he would go blind. And that's why they never had it. He could have been guaranteed $1 million even if he lost that third fight. And that was what was something that was really too bad in history. But Dad understood Dempsey's decision on that. And he never questioned.
You know what the joke of that is? Your father was such a gentleman, despite, you know, being such a great, wonderful boxer and, you know, athlete. But
yes.
The Heaney fight, your father talked about the fact that he could have – Heaney was down, right? And
yes.
He was temporarily blinded, and your father could have taken him out, and not just in that fight, but there were a number of fights he didn't go in for the kill.
That's exactly it. That was the irony of it. He was a gentleman in the ring. He really didn't have the killer instinct. But he had the scientific instinct of how, like how a doctor will use his scalpel on a patient. That's what Dad, he didn't have his heart in it. He didn't have this passion that people have and go crazy in the ring, that kind of thing. He didn't
right.
have that.
So, which is
cool
an interesting thing. All that strength that he had, all
yeah.
that art that he had,
that's
got
it.
Him
it
through. It's
that's
the art.
Exactly what it was.
And so he retires
exactly.
undefeated, and I'm sorry, I'm going to have to rush you through some of this. He retires
yes.
undefeated, and he wants to move on with his life. He wants privacy, and he's fallen in love with
yes.
your, who became your
mother.
Mom, Polly,
yes.
a steel heiress. And he didn't think that marriage and fighting went together. In fact, she never really saw him fight. She couldn't handle that, right? But the press was not kind to him, and they wouldn't really let him do what he wanted to do, and that was to go on to be the great erudite athlete that he wanted. So what a sad tale for that. Did he ever find peace in retirement?
The minute he quit the ring, because it really was like a swamp in a way. It was like a swamp. There was some great, you know, the great art of boxing and fighting was a wonderful thing to be in, but there was a lot of betting and a lot of pretty foul characters that were in it. He wasn't sorry to see the end of that, no. And then marry the girl that he loved and then live like a normal guy for the rest of his life out in North Stamford, Connecticut, and grow a normal family with four kids, three boys and a girl. No, he didn't regret that a bit. And then go on to become a very successful businessman and become a successful writer of some sort. He didn't become the professional writer he would have liked to have become, but he did become a great businessman. And so, no, he didn't regret one single thing that happened after he retired, except that maybe he did not have the image, a lasting image of a great American hero who had the finest record in boxing history in the ring. But he did come back to some of the main sports writers like Westbrook Bagler and Paul Gallico of the Daily News and made good friends with those guys and let them understand who they had misunderstood in the ring. That was Dad. That was Gene Tunney. And that was what was nice about it and why we all ended up with a peace of mind and no problem.
Yeah, right.
That's
question
idea.
For you.
Yeah.
Out of everything that he did, boxing, marriage, the children, what do you think was the thing that he counted as the best accomplishment of his life?
The heavyweight championship, without a doubt.
No question.
And
okay.
A very close second was his marriage to my mother. Absolutely. Very close second. But, you know, one without the other, I mean, that's hard to say. It made him who he was, the boxing champion of the world. And that was the single most important moment when he beat Dempsey in 1926.
Wow, amazing. One word answer. What was he like as a father?
He was a great Irish father. And he a little authoritarian, but a wonderful sense of humor, and he taught us to be normal people. That's
he was very successful. He had some very successful children, so he and Polly did something right. Did he fail at anything?
Say it again.
Did he fail at anything?
No, that was the shadow that was hard to get out from under, is the fact that he didn't do much failing. He really didn't. That's right.
Do you miss him?
Yes, I do, in a big way. I love he got. I do miss him. I miss his sense of humor very much.
Your mom also lived for a ripe old age. Boy, she was what, almost
101, shy by 12 days, 101, and she was a terrific, dignified lady her whole life. Just she was a moderate all her life. Dad was a bit of an extremist, but that goes with the Irish. Mother was Scottish all the way through and very moderate in her taste. But she was a lovely human being, lovely lady.
I know now two of her children. Jay, thank you so much for being on the show. It's just been fabulous. I wish we had a whole lot more time. I can't thank you enough. The book, The Prize Fighter and the Playwright, if you love the sport, you'll love, I mean love this book. If you don't, you'll garner a new respect for it and will fall in love with Gene Tunney and the Tunney family. Thank you again, Jay. For more information, to the website www.tunney-shaw.com and find more on Facebook at Penned and Glove.
Retired IBF and the ring light and heavyweight champion, Glenn Johnson, has had quite a career, and he is quite a guy. Glenn finished his 20-year professional boxing career with a final record of 51 wins, 17 losses, and 2 draws. He won 35 of his fights by knockout. In February 2004, Glenn won the World Light Heavyweight Championship and later that year defeated Roy Jones Jr. and Antonio Tarver in title fights. Glenn was voted the 2004 Fighter of the Year by the Boxing Writers Association of America. But what makes Glenn's story interesting is that for the first 7 to 8 years as a professional fighter, Glenn worked full-time in construction. He would finish his construction shift and head to the gym and train for his fights. As a result, Glenn rightfully earned the championship riches and rewarding paydays that came later in his career. Now that he has fought his last bout, Glenn is looking forward to the transition from boxing. Always admired for his conditioning throughout his career, he's become a personal trainer. Hi, Glenn. Welcome to the Hallicaster Jane Show.
Thanks for having me on. After that introduction, I don't know how I'm going to keep up.
You're going to do just fine, buddy. I promise. So, Glenn, light heavyweight champion, your thoughts on the career of Gene Tunney? I mean, his influence on your own career?
Oh, yeah. I mean, you know, these are the guys that set the pace for us that come after. I mean, they make boxing what it is. We walk on their shoulders to get to where we are today.
Yeah, gosh, I mean, right? Hard act to follow, but something to learn from. You're originally from Jamaica, or now a Miami boy, and you got into the game late. What made you want to become a prize fighter? Was it the guts, the glory, both, something? Tell me about this. I want to get into the mind why one does this.
I dream of having a better life than what you're living in. I started boxing when I was 20 years old. That's late for a professional boxer. That's the time when guys normally becoming a world champion, you know. So, you know, it was a learning process for me from the jump. So, you know, it's a difficult business, and it's tough when you're already learning it, when you just start learning it as a 20-year-old. So, you know, and I was working construction, didn't really content with where I was and wanted to find something better. And walk into a boxing gym, wanted to lose weight and end up finding a career there.
Why boxing? Why not golf or football or tennis?
I mean, you know, it's a coincidence. I actually wanted to lose some weight and you know, there was opening up a gym in my community. The Miami Police Athletic Program was opening up a gym in Coconut Grove where I was living at the time in the ghetto. And one day I was walking by and I stopped by and asked the gentleman that was inside what they're doing here. He basically said it's a gym and it's a community gym. If you live in the area, it's for free. And at the time, free fit into my budget, so I joined.
Talk to me about your training. You're an athlete first. But do you also have to train your mind, and is that Tunney thing really true today? I mean, you've got to be mind and body and what?
Oh, it's all about the mental. I mean, the mind has to be focused, and it has to be ready for what you're asking your body and your mind to do. Because if you're not mentally ready or mentally strong, pain will change your mind immediately. You know, being any athlete, you're going to face tremendous pain. And in boxing, obviously, it's made of pain. So just had another level of pain to the business.
We're going to talk about pain in a second, but let me ask you a question. In your mind, is boxing the most painful sport?
Oh yeah, I think so. It's not the most fatal sport, because I think football might be. You don't see a lot of guys come out of boxing, really crippled. Sometimes they might see them punch drunk or something like that, where they lose their speech, not speaking so clearly, and stuff like that. And very rare where you find a death happen in boxing. But, in football, we see some serious injury, and all the level, high school, college, and professional. So I would give that sport the danger factor.
Huh.
But boxing definitely painful.
You and I were introduced to one another by Miami Herald writer and all-around great guy, Santos Perez. Are you listening? I asked him why your nickname, the Gentleman in the Road Warrior. And here was Santos's answer. I thought you'd like to hear it. He said, the gentleman, because he never talked down his opponents or bragged about what he would do to them, like many of the alley influences fighters of the past 40 years. And he also said that you had a deep appreciation for fight fans, always cordial with fans and media. And as far as the Warrior, Santos said, the Road Warrior nickname was created because Glenn never feared going to his opponent's hometowns for a fight. In fact, Glenn lost many close and disputed decisions under these types of situations. Was your image and your honor as important to you as your skill?
Oh, yeah, definitely. And he was right on. He was right on with all the things he said, and I thank him for putting it in more eloquent words than I probably would have, but... but he's right on though, and I was plagued by those bad decisions in hometowns. My career got thrown off course a few times behind those decisions, but I stayed with it. I never gave up on myself. I never quit. I always believed that just keep working hard, I could make a difference for myself. I could change my life. It was the only thing I was working for, and I wasn't going to let anybody discourage me.
Mm, gosh, I love guys like you. So focused. I asked Jay Tunney about his father's fear. What about fear? How does fear play into all of this?
Can I say that again?
Fear. How does fear play
fear.
Into it?
My fear was not so much of my opponent or anything. It was just fear of failing. That was the only fear that I walk with. If I didn't supersede my expectation of myself. I know a lot of people that know me and I was around me didn't have a lot of expectation of me. So that, and then if I didn't live up to myself, then I would prove them right. So it was always that extra pressure that I put on myself to succeed against the odds. And that's what I think might add to my determination that I fight with, and the determination that I train with, and the determination that I keep pushing my career forward with. So, that was my fear. And it plays a big part. It was very, very valuable for me.
Wow, that's fascinating. What about the pain? What do you do with knowing that the pain is going to come?
For me, I always think of the pain would mean that you need to have better skills, because the better your skills is the more you can protect yourself from the pain, is the more that the pain won't happen. So I spend a lot of time training in the gym, staying focused on defense, staying focused and getting better skills to make sure that I can minimize the pain and inflict the pain.
Your favorite matchup, favorite fight, your most memorable moment in boxing, Clinton Woods, Roy Jones Jr., what?
My favorite moment is the Clinton Woods fight. My most recognized moment is the Roy Jones fight.
And your favorite? It was the Clinton Woods.
My favorite, I would probably go with the Clinton Woods fight, because that's the fight where I won my world championship. And, any person decides to do a sport, they're always looking at the championship of whatever sport that is. You want to be the champion of your craft. So when you win your championship, it has to be your favorite and the greatest moment for you.
Gosh, imagine getting to that. That's just so brilliant that you got there. Here's something that I read about you. It was written by ESPN's Jason Langendorf following your last fight. Listen to this, guys. This is amazing. In boxing's endings are almost never awash in glory. They're ugly or bloody, sometimes embarrassing or shameful. A fighter's swan song isn't a battle cry but a whimper. Yet it was none of those things for Johnson, 51-17 to 35 knockouts. I imagine going in that one of those things a boxer fears most is the end of his career. Is that true?
Yeah. You know, I just jumped up and retired. I felt like if I wasn't going to beat this guy, then I would not get back to where I want to be. And if I couldn't get back to that, then it didn't make any sense I keep on boxing. I wasn't planning on retiring. I didn't make preparation for it because I thought I would have gone out there and won my fight clearly and move on with my career. That didn't happen. And I just made the decision right there and came home and started putting a plan together how I move forward.
You didn't have a plan during your boxing career days? You just kind of thought you would wing it?
my plan for my boxing days while I was boxing was always to wait till I retire to move on because I did construction and box. And it's not easy to do. You really need to stay focused on boxing if you're a professional boxer. You want to stay focused. So for me, I'd say when my career finished, I would move on to something else. And I have some thoughts of what I would like to do. I mean, what I end up doing have nothing to do with what my plans were to do. I'm starting something fresh right now, brand new, different from anything that I thought about doing prior.
What are you going to do?
I'm actually now putting my business together for professional training, boxing training for the public, businessmen and businesswomen who want to get fit, learn self-defense, learn how to eat and get their body right.
Sounds like a good idea. I'm coming to your gym. I'll be your first, I promise. You can use me. I have another question for you.
I'm definitely looking forward to it.
What did you learn most about being a prize fighter?
From being
a prize fighter?
I learned so many things, though. But one thing I would say, the drive that you have to have to succeed, that was not evident to me before boxing and then doing boxing I learned that and it grew in me and it was in me but something was, you know, kind of laying there until it have a reason to rise and through boxing it rose and I'm very thankful and happy about that.
Would you recommend it as a career for others?
Certainly if you know exactly what you're getting into, because if you don't know, it will shock and surprise you and set you on a whole different course. So, you know, I speak to many people about, many young men about boxing, and I always try to give them as much information that I can about the sport. I have my own son who play around in boxing as well. Glenn Jr. And I told him, I said, you know, I'm never will tell you to box or, you know, that will be your decision. And again, he have decent skills. I mean, I think if he dedicates himself to it, it's something he can do. But I would not drive him or tell him to do it or don't do it. That would have to be a decision that he have to make. And I told him all the information that I have about boxing. I already gave it to him, and if he want it again, I give it to him again. But, you know, you have to go in there well informed, and you set yourself up for success if you know what you're doing.
Glenn Johnson, as I've come to know him, and now you, a truly gentle man. Hey, Glenn, thanks so much.
Oh, thank you. I appreciate the moment.
Oh, loved it.
Rick Encinosa is one of the top boxing historians in the world. Enrique Rick Encinosa is a former amateur light heavyweight and Indiana State champ who has worked as a fight manager for more than 20 fighters and was a matchmaker from 1981 to 2006, working with more than 100 pro boxing cards. From 1984 to 1989, Rick served as color commentator for 40 televised boxing shows in Florida. A voting member of the International Boxing Hall of Fame, he is author of hundreds of boxing articles and columns for Ring Magazine, Boxing Digest, and Boxing Illustrated. He served as historical consultant for the movie Cinderella Man. He also served as Florida editor for the Ring Record Book during the 1980s and was publisher of the Florida Boxing Record Book from 1984 to 1986. He is a 2010 inductee to the Florida Boxing Hall of Fame, and I want to welcome Rick Encinosa to the Hallie Kasser Jane Show. Hi, Rick.
It's a pleasure being here. I've been listening to the show, and it's terrific.
Ah, you're a sweetheart. You are kind.
I don't know if you knew, but when Gene Tunney's son was running for Congress, Jack Dempsey went and did speeches for him. the campaign for.
Yeah, this is very funny. I worked on that campaign. I was just a baby, and I was Jay and I. I've known the family for a long time, and Jay and I were just talking about that. So I was right there with all of that. How do you like that?
Mm-hmm. And I wish I'd met Sonny.
I was like 18, 17.
I was 17 when I met Dempsey.
Yeah, really. Boy, aren't you lucky. What was he like?
Well, he was like my hero of all time, you know. He was like, he was my hero of all time. One of my favorite fighter of all time.
Really, really. I mean,
yeah.
did you like Jay's description of him?
Well, yeah, because you know, I think he would have beaten Tony if he had been younger, because he was shot. You know, he was a shot fighter by the time he fought Tony. But no, what happened with Dempsey was when I was 12 years old and I got into boxing. There was a book called Jack Dempsey by Dean Shore, which was geared to the junior high school level, and every boxer I knew who was 14, 15 years old read that book. So Dempsey was the first book I ever read on boxing, and it got me into the historian side of it, besides the fact that I was boxing. I was a light heavyweight, now I'm an overweight. But, yeah, Dempsey was a fascinating guy.
Talk to me about this, this boxing thing. You know, I'm fairly new to this. I've been around it most of my life, you know, from my dad and stuff, but I really never got involved in it. I'm absolutely fascinated by this now. I had no idea what was entailed, you know, until I did all this research this week. But I've also had a lot of people writing me, you know, are my fans and what have you, and saying it's not what it used to be, you know, it's days are over, blah, blah. What are your feelings on that?
Well, you know, the death of boxing has been predicted like every year since the days of the Roman Empire. But it hasn't, no. I think it goes up and down in cycles depending on who it is. Right now, the heavyweight division is kind of dead because the Klitschkos have controlled it so superbly for so many years.
Who has control? I didn't hear you. Who has?
The Klitschko brothers.
Okay. All right. Yep.
But,
okay.
But in a sense, the American fans or the American television, which rules American fans, has kind of given up on the heavyweight division. And, you know, boxing's popularity in the United States is based more or less on the heavyweight division more than anything else. But boxing is in a very healthy state. You have very good fighters, you know, like Manny Pacquiao, Mayweather, Bradley, in the lighter weight divisions. In Germany, it's booming. In Spain, it's booming again. Mexico, it's always booming. You could throw a rock and hit a featherweight. So, you know, it all depends on your geographical situation. It's a big business. There's a lot of money involved, and there's a lot of politics involved, which is a part I like the least.
Question about this, what you were talking about, though. Is one of the problems right now the fact that so many of our kids in school today or what have you are going into other sports because they look sexier or whatever, maybe easier? Football, basketball are taking a lot away from. Do you buy into that argument?
No, I buy into the fact that there's not enough facilities, you know, because when the county government has a problem, the first thing you do is you cut out the boxing program and you hire three more executives at $200,000 a year. But, you know, and the hell with the trainers and the gyms. That's one thing. I don't think there's enough boxing programs. I think, and I know people that are trying to establish now again, that what used to be the National Collegiate Boxing Association, where there was boxing in colleges. And to a degree, it's being done right now in Chico State and Nevada. And in the West Coast, there's a half a dozen schools that have boxing programs that, you know, are doing varsity competition. And I think another thing that needs to be fixed tremendously is the USA Boxing, which is the amateur program, which caused a disaster here in the Olympics. They have just, Olympic boxing has become fencing, and these guys are not ready to turn pro. Because when they turn pro, they only know how to fight at one distance, like a fencing distance, and they don't know how to bob and weave. They don't know how to fight in close. They don't know how to fight at middle distance.
How do you fix that? But how do you fix that if there's no place to train properly?
Well, I think there should be more involvement in sports programs geared, you know, towards boxing, which is an excellent sport for self-defense. It is the martial arts of the Western world, it's been called.
Right. But now what's this thing with mixed martial arts? Isn't that, people are saying that that's kind of stepping into the boxing dominance? What's mixed martial arts?
You know, I've I have friends who are mixed martial arts, and I've gone to see mixed martial arts, and I find it boring. It's more like a street fight.
Huh.
A little bit of wrestling, a little bit of judo, a little bit of punching, you know, but it just doesn't thrill me. I mean, you know, I come from a very upper-middle-class family. My mother got me into swimming, you know, because with a country club and all this when I was a kid. And then one day, I got into an argument with a kid. I mean, I was the kind of kid at 12 years old. I read Sartre, you know, and Jeanette, and you know, as surrealism and existentialism, you know, I was way ahead of my reading at the age of 12. And so to behold the great surprise, you know, I got into an argument in a school. There was a gym next door. Next thing I know, I'm in the ring, and I looked it. And the following week, my parents were called into school because I was picking fights with everybody.
Oh, gosh.
But it wasn't because I was a bully. It was just I just wanted to get back in the ring, you know? So that's how I got started in boxing. And the historical aspect was because, you know, having an intellectual sense, you know, like you were saying, George Bernard Shaw, Lord Byron, Joyce Carol Oates, Norman Mailer. Most intellectuals are fascinated with boxing. It's not golf. Golf is white people wearing funny clothing. But boxing has so many different characters, good, bad. It's such a delicious mix of people. It's such incredible stories of failure and defeat and overcoming obstacles.
Failure, defeat, and amazing wins.
But that's, see, that's the thing. You know, in life, I wasn't a great fighter, but in life, boxing taught me never to give up, never to surrender.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, it sounds to me like it needs to be in more schools. I don't think we're raising tough kids today. Do you agree?
Yeah.
I mean, it's a problem. There's a lot of graft in this game. And is there hope for the future that it can clean itself up? What?
I'll tell you what, I think I have seen it from all perspectives. You know, you hear the traditional Hollywood story that the manager rips off the fighter. It's usually the other way around. What I've seen is a lot of fighters take advantage of the managers, and in 99% of the cases, when you're managing a fighter, it's because of ego. It's because, you know, you might own a hardware store, but it sounds better to say I manage a fighter or I'm a boxing promoter. So in many ways, boxers as investments become tax deductions, but, you know, there's not that much money in it. There's not that much money, you know, at the four-round level, at the six-round level, at the eight-round level, and that's where most fighters stay. You know, there's only one in 300 or 400 that makes it to television.
Right.
And then you have to fight a lot in order to make a lot more money, because television fights might start 4,000, 5,000, 6,000. So when you hear about the $10 million purses, that's just 10 or 15 guys in the whole world making that.
Hmm. I'll tell you, I could talk to you about this for hours. I'm so into this now, I'm in trouble.
Well, call me anytime you want.
I will, Rick.
And I'll give you.
I absolutely will, and I can't thank you enough. I wish I had 1,000 hours, as I said, but this is all we've got. So thank you, Rick Encinoza, and look for his work because he really is the go-to guy on this sport right now.
My guests today, J.R. Tunney, Glenn Johnson, and Rick Encinoza. And I want to give a special shout-out to Santos Perez, another gentleman from the world of boxing, recently inducted into the Florida Boxing Hall of Fame. Thanks, Santos. Before I go, I want to remind everyone that podcasts of current and past shows are always available to listen to free on iTunes under The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show is also available for download via Spreaker.com, Stitcher.com, BlogTalkRadio.com, and a host of other venues. Google The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show and you will find us. Of course, podcasts of our shows, both past and present, are always posted for your listening pleasure at HallieKasserJane.com. Which I hope you'll visit often for the latest information on our upcoming segments. Oh, and while you're at HallieKasserJane.com, don't forget to visit my blog to read my latest musings. I'll be back next week, same time, 3 p.m. Eastern, for another edition of the Hallie Kasser-Jane Show, Talk Radio for Fine Minds, brought to you by Audible.com. Get a free audiobook download at www.audibletrial.com/The Hallie Kasser-Jane Show. Audible.com features over 100,000 titles to choose from for your iPhone, Android, Kindle, or MP3 player. Stay in touch, won't you? Remember, that's HallieKasserJane.com. Discover us on Facebook at HallieKasserJane and on Twitter at HallieCJ. I love to hear from you. So, till we meet again, this is Hallie Kasser-Jane. It's a wrap.